what makes stories of sex and murder set in New Orleans so good? Gary Crist will join us to talk about his new book, Empire of Sin.
I think it really does appeal to people's sense of the exotic, but also a place where these puritanical elements in the American character are perhaps less pronounced.
What are the best new books for children this fall? Maria Russo, our new children's book editor, will join us to talk about the latest novels for kids and the winners of this year's Best Illustrated Book Awards.
We're calling them meta books. They're books that play with the form of being a book. So you'll have the book talking or the book becoming a character.
Alexander Alter will join me with notes from the publishing world. And Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Gary Crist joins us now. He is the author, most recently, of Empire of Sin, a story of sex, jazz, murder, and the battle for modern New Orleans, reviewed this week in the book review by Walter Isaacson. Hi, Gary.
Hi.
So tell us what this story of sex, jazz, and murder is.
Well, clearly the title is intended to incite a little bit of salacious interest, but there's a lot of I like to think there's a lot of good serious history in it. It's basically about a 30-year effort running from 1890 to 1920 by reformers in New Orleans to basically clean the city up. New Orleans had, by the late 1880s, gotten a really bad reputation for violence and crime. They had fallen behind economically. Their infrastructure was terrible. As a matter of fact, one of my favorite quotations about New Orleans is Roy Blunt's observation that the city was the first major American metropolis to build an opera house, but the last to install a sewer system. So anyway, they needed money to improve their infrastructure, but the northern capitalists that they needed, you know, that was where all the money was at this time. It was up in New York and Boston and Philadelphia. They were reluctant to invest in New Orleans because it was this sort of exotic-seeming place with a very bad reputation for vice and crime. So basically, the city's so-called better half, which in this case was mostly wealthy Anglo-American elites, decided we've got to make New Orleans into a more orderly, business-like place that would be a better proposition for these capitalists. So they took arms against the various elements in the population that they regarded as disruptive, that were creating this bad reputation. So they first of all felt we have to do something about the notorious crime problem, which involved taking on the Sicilian underworld, which they called mafia, but I prefer to call it a proto-mafia. They also felt that they had to get their racial house in order, and this involved suppressing the local African-American population, in particular the mixed-race African-American population, the Creoles of color, who for decades had enjoyed a really special status in New Orleans. But they decided this is disruptive, we've got to get rid of this. So this is when you saw the rise of Jim Crow and also the active suppression of jazz. It's hard for us now to think of jazz as subversive, but it was really considered morally corrupting and altogether too inducive to interracial contacts.
The hip-hop of its day.
Right, exactly. As a matter of fact, there was a time in New Orleans when they were thinking of prohibiting jazz just the way they would prohibit alcohol. But the third part involved getting a handle on this vice and prostitution problem, which had never been minor in New Orleans. By the 1880s, it had just gotten out of hand. There were brothels cropping up in all kinds of reputable neighborhoods. So they decided to create this thing called Storyville. You know, most people think it's the creation of some venal machine politicians, but it was actually a progressive reform. They thought, well, we can't eradicate prostitution entirely, so mm-hmm. Why don't we be pragmatic and we'll set aside this one neighborhood. Basically, they made prostitution illegal everywhere except in that one neighborhood. So they didn't actually legalize prostitution. They said, we'll draw it out of the respectable neighborhoods and put it in this out-of-the-way place where it wouldn't be so visible and where, quote-unquote, respectable people wouldn't have to come into contact with it. And, you know, for the first few years, it worked pretty well. But then it became wildly successful, and they realized, basically, they had created a monster.
Let's talk a little bit about a Storyville and what it looked like. One of the things you mention is the Blue Book that was published as a guide to the area's better prostitutes, and then it annotated them with symbols. What did those symbols designate?
Well, there was W for white, C for colored, J for Jewish, and OCT for octoroon, which was their definition for a very light-skinned black prostitute. And they were openly advertised. Since it was a legally tolerated district, they could do that. But there was always a note at the end of the Blue Book saying, you cannot mail this guide through the U.S. mails because it would have been considered obscene. But it really was a very businesslike sex district. And I think, you know, I have a very mixed feeling about Storyville. On the one hand, any exchange of sex for money is going to be degrading to both sides, but it was conducted in a very businesslike way, and a lot of people made a lot of good money. You know, a lot of working-class people, a lot of women, a lot of African-Americans. These people did not have other avenues to economic success in New Orleans at this time, and they made a ton of money in the Storyville years.
The man that put the Blue Book together, the so-called mayor of Storyville, Tom Anderson, is a major figure in the book. Who was Tom Anderson?
Well, he was really like a character out of Horatio Alger. He was this short, scrappy kid from the rough Irish Channel neighborhood. He just rose through the ranks. He made friends wherever he went. He exchanged favors. And eventually, he had a whole portfolio of cabarets, nightclubs, and brothels, and he came to be known as the mayor of Storyville. It was said that there wasn't a single transaction that went down in Storyville of which he didn't get a cut. That's probably an exaggeration, but he was the dominant figure, and he actually represented the Fourth Ward, which was the ward that contained Storyville, in the Louisiana House of Representatives. So he had some success on the legitimate side as well.
We usually think of reformers as, you know, do-gooders. In this case, as you alluded to earlier, the side of the moral good doesn't necessarily line up quite so neatly. What was the role of race and class in terms of how that motivated these reforms of Storyville?
Well, the astonishing thing is that a lot of these reformers, part of whose agenda I think is really laudable, you know, they were working for female suffrage, they were working for child labor laws, but they were also working for the disenfranchisement of African Americans, a lot of things that we would not think of as progressive in our century.
Mm-hmm.
But they thought that having African American voters was a disruptive thing. And so there are reformers like Jean Gordon who, you know, you hear her on one topic and she sounds perfectly reasonable, but you hear her on the race topic and she sounds appalling.
In New Orleans at that time, you, of course, have former slaves, you have Creoles, Brazilians, Spaniards, Haitians, Germans. I think in the review, Walter Isaacson says it wasn't so much a melting pot as a gumbo pot. How distinctive was this intermingling of people in New Orleans? Was that typical of the South at the time or even of Louisiana, or was that really particular to the city?
It was really particular to New Orleans. Because it was a French city, its first 100 years, it was basically a little part of France on the North American continent. And, you know, even after Napoleon sold it to the United States in 1803, those Franco-Latin roots remained. And I do think that there is a different attitude. The attitude was much more cosmopolitan. It was much more permissive in terms of not only sex, but also race. So it was an anomaly in the South. And I think that was part of what the reformers were reacting against. They wanted to make it more like Atlanta, basically, because Atlanta was outstripping them economically.
We've talked a little bit about the sex, touched lightly on the jazz. There's also murder in the subtitle of your book, and a serial killer. I don't want you to give everything away, but what's the story there?
Well, there was he came out of nowhere. He's the so-called Axeman of New Orleans. And He terrorized the city for about 18 months in late 1918, early 1919. Basically, he would chisel out the back panels of people's doors and go inside and just hack them to death brutally. And his one of my favorite stories of the Axeman reign is that his reign culminated in March of 1919 when he wrote, or someone purporting to be the Axeman, wrote an open letter to the Times-Picayune newspaper in which he identified himself as a fell demon from hottest hell who nonetheless had a taste for the new jazz music. And so he said that he was going to strike again on St. Joseph's Night, which falls in March, but that he would spare any household in which jazz was being played. So you can just imagine what a wild night of music and dancing they had in New Orleans that St. Joseph's Night. But they never were able to identify who it was. His reign ended, and they just never found out. There were a few suspects, but nothing that convinces me.
One of your previous books was City of Scoundrels, a bestseller. That was about Chicago, right?
Yes.
What brought you to New Orleans and to this story? You're not a native New Orleans.
No, and I'm not a native Chicagoan either.
Okay.
I'm really interested in the Progressive Era. I've made a specialty of the Progressive Era in my nonfiction books. And I thought, well, in City of Scoundrels, I talked about Chicago, which was this middle American industrial giant. And why don't I see how the same issues played out in a very, very different urban area? And there's no place more different than New Orleans, which is the antithesis to middle American, and it's very small and not very industrial. So I do think of the books almost as two parts of the same idea. I do explore the racial issues and how they played out in these two very different environments.
Chicago is obviously a great source of good fiction and nonfiction, but people just love stories about New Orleans. What's the draw? Why the romance around that city and its sort of sordid side?
Well, it's you know, basically what's in my subtitle, I think. It's the sex, jazz, and murder. The fact that it has a French heritage, I think, appeals to people, since France always seems to have an appeal to people. And I think people respond to the cosmopolitan, easy, tolerant atmosphere that the reformers were basically trying to change. It's just a very colorful place. And the food is great, for one thing. I can attest to that, having made 13 research trips down there. So I think it really does appeal to people's sense of the exotic, but also just a place where, I don't know, these puritanical elements in the American character are perhaps less pronounced.
I think we're still living in a kind of post-Katrina world when we think of New Orleans, and there's obviously a lot of the after effects still there. Did you think about that when you were working on the book? Did you see sort of roots to what happened in Katrina in the research you did?
The struggle between a sort of wealthy white elite and the rest of the city is something that's played out in the post-Katrina world. I mean, there's a big debate still going on down there over, you know, what kind of city do we want? You know, do we want it to be, you know, a city for white hipsters? Or, you know, do we want this complete culture with poor people and black people and, you know, Hispanic people and Vietnamese people? And, you know, there is some concern down there that it's becoming a much richer, much whiter city, which, you know, there are advantages to that, but it's losing a lot in the process.
Losing that gumbo flavor.
Right.
All right. Thank you so much, Gary.
All right. Thank you.
Gary Crist, again, is the author of Empire of Sin, a story of sex, jazz, murder, and the battle for modern New Orleans. Alexandra Alter joins me now to talk about what's going on in the book world. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, Pamela.
So despite the often depressing news in the industry, this was actually a week of lots of big fancy deals, right?
There have been a ton of enormous book deals happening, and it's been going on for a while, but it really picked up around Frankfurt, as it often did in the lead up to Frankfurt. Random House bought two debut novels for seven figures, and just last week, one of our own reporters, Stephanie Clifford, sold her first novel to St. Martin's Press in a low seven-figure deal and sold the movie rights.
Wow. When you think about how much money there is in journalism, why would she need to go and do that? That's very exciting. And also, some people who perhaps didn't need the money have gotten some great book deals recently. What's going on with Tom Hanks?
Tom Hanks sold, you would think he would sell perhaps a memoir, but in fact, he sold a short story collection that is loosely connected to his vintage typewriter collection to Alfred A. Knopf this week. This comes right on the heels of his fiction debut in The New Yorker. He wrote a short story that ran a few weeks ago. It ran last month. And, you know, there were mixed reviews, I would say, on the internet. Someone at Slate was writing about it and said the headline was Tom Hanks has published a short story in The New Yorker. It's not very good. You know, there's a little bit of criticism of The New Yorker for sort of giving its pages over to celebrities. Increasingly, you're seeing a lot of actors publishing their fiction there.
Who else is part of the trend?
The Slate article, which was written by Katie Waldman, pointed out, you know, Mindy Kaling, Steve Martin, Lena Dunham, Jesse Eisenberg. Of course, Steve Martin, you know, some of these people can write well. Some of them
Woody Allen.
Woody Allen, exactly. I mean, Woody Allen is one of the stellar examples. Of course, there's been the whole James Franco trend as well with his poetry and fiction, but we're seeing more and more of this. So
can't they just stick to writing memoirs?
Or acting, but who knows? I mean, we'll see what the short story collection is like from Tom Hanks. He's a real typewriter fanatic. He's got he's been collecting them since 1978, and apparently, you know, he said in the press release, these stories aren't about the typewriters, but there's something that might have been written on the typewriters.
The snarky line, I guess, is it's fine to collect those things, just don't use them.
Sure, exactly. And he said that for more complicated, he likes to write thank you notes on them, but it sounds like he'll be writing the actual stories on a Word processor like anyone else working in the 21st century. So,
and then there was a book deal, a big deal, with a very established writer.
Yes, some established writers have been getting also, you know, larger money than we've been seeing lately. Just this week, Publishers Marketplace reported that Echo paid more than $3 million for Charles Frazier's fourth novel, which is a remarkable amount for a single book. Earlier, a few weeks ago, Diana Gabaldon from the Outlander series sold the ninth book in that series to Random House for more than $6 million.
And Danielle Steele, didn't she sign like a 15-book deal?
It was a 10-book deal, so she'll be around writing for quite a while. But, you know, I'm looking at some of these numbers and thinking, well, sales of adult trade books are down still, you know, in the first 7 months of 2014, almost 3%. The only category that's really booming is children's and, you know, young adult, as we've talked about before. So publishers, I suppose, are feeling bullish, and they think, you know, print sales, you know, ebook sales have sort of plateaued a little bit, and print, you know, is dipping, but it's not plunging. So they're making some big bets and hoping that, you know, these splashy books will get people into bookstores and shopping. So
things will turn around in 2015.
We'll see.
All right. Thanks, Alexandra.
Thanks for having me.
Our children's book editor, Maria Russo, joins us now. Hi, Maria.
Hi.
This is an exciting moment of the year. It's not only our biggest children's book issue of the year, but also the time when we select the 10 best illustrated books of the year in our 62nd year now. Do you want to talk a little bit about who the judges were and how it works?
Sure. We had three great judges this year. Jenny Brown, who is the director of the Center for Children's Literature at Bank Street College of Education, and then two illustrators who themselves have won Best Illustrated Awards, Brian Floca, who wrote Locomotive, which won last year, wrote and illustrated, and many other picture books, a lot of vehicle-oriented. His most recent one is called Five Trucks. And then Jerry Pinkney, who is kind of a legend in the picture book world. He's done over 100 children's books. His most famous is The Lion and the Mouse, which won a Best Illustrated Award and also a Caldecott Medal.
Actually, both of them Caldecott medalists, which
is
really wonderful.
Yeah.
And they selected, I think, a really interesting, diverse group of books. Talk about some of the winners this year.
Oh, it's an amazing group, and it's a beautiful spread in the book review on coming on Sunday. You can see Shackleton's Journey, which is a really wonderful book by William Grill, a British illustrator about Shackleton. But somehow he makes it very almost homey and delicate, his artwork in the book, and tons of detail. Just a really great kind of big picture book for a slightly older children.
Then, there was a another Shackleton
graphic novel. It's a big Shackleton year
that came out.
Yeah,
it's always such a great topic for kids. And one of the things I liked about this one was that the publisher is Flying Eye, which I think is part of Nobrow. It's this great,
really small, group. Independent, very sort of design oriented publishing house. And this is their first. So they've only been around for a couple of years, and their first time winning a Best Illustrated Award. Yeah, and then for going slightly younger, we had some baby-oriented books. We had The Baby Tree by Sophie Blackall, who's a big favorite around here. It's a kind of a birds and the bees book, but with a lot of interesting twists. So that's a boy trying to figure out where babies come from.
But I think this is her second win for Best Illustrator.
Oh, right, yeah.
And she also served as a judge a couple of years ago.
And then Barbara McClintock, who is really kind of a knockout illustrator, who also has won before. Her book is called Where's Mommy? It's written by Beverly D'Onofrio, but the illustrations are so detailed, so much to look at, both the tiny details of this girl and all her toys in the house, and a mouse who's living a parallel life kind of on the bottom level of the house in the page. That one is really outstanding.
Do you have a favorite among the others?
Well, emotionally, I have to say Harlem Hellfighters was really powerful. A book about the World War I regiment that came from Harlem, but the illustrations by Gary Kelly, they're just wrenching and powerful. And he did a lot of kind of big scale, the parade when they came home with the American flags, just gorgeous scenes of that, but also close-ups of the soldiers' faces. That one, I think. And that's also by a small publisher, Creative Editions. It's nice to see when.
And it was then, one of three books, I think, about the Harlem Hellfighters that came out
this
year.
Another one. I think it's
year.
An anniversary year for, yeah, also.
For the World War I centenary. Anything else?
And then, you know, I should mention the Raoul Cologne Draw, because it's a wordless picture book. And that's another trend that is going strong right now. We've had some really great wordless books reviewed. And this one especially really stands out. He has a way of creating this warmth and detail, and that the story kind of comes alive. It's a boy who is stuck in bed sick and decides to start drawing, and draws this journey into Africa where he comes across all kinds of animals and adventurous scenes, and it's really anyone could enjoy that book, any age.
One of the things that makes the Best Illustrated Awards so distinctive is that it's really the only purely illustration award for children's books that's out there. The Caldecott is sort of for the book in its entirety. And these are really about the art. But there are also many great stories in this year's issue. Do you want to talk about some of the other picture books? We started off the issue with what we're referring to as the meta picture books.
Yeah, this is another interesting trend in picture books. We're calling them meta books. They're books that play with the form of being a book. So you'll have the book talking or the book becoming a character. And the kids, you know, there's a lot of humor and cleverness in this. So one that was the ones that we reviewed five in this issue. One is called A Perfectly Messed Up Story, and that's a fun one where there's actually peanut butter and jelly splotches on the pages, and the character is complaining, hey, who's putting peanut butter and jelly on me, and you're ruining my story. And
tell us about The Jacket, which I think was one that you particularly
liked.
That
one I really loved. It's kind of a young illustrator, Dasha Tolstikova, and the author's also, I think, her first picture book, Kristen Hall. In this one, the book is the girl's favorite thing until she gets a dog, and then the dog is competition, and the dog actually kind of trashes the book, and the book is miserable, and the cover is ruined, and then the girl sets about creating a new jacket. She draws her own jacket for the book, and then the book is happy at the end, and it is the actual jacket on the actual book, the one that you can see the girl drawing in the book. So it's really fun and also just beautiful and a nicely told story. You kind of could feel the emotions of this book when he's supplanted by the dog.
I think also in there is the Book with No Pictures by B.J. Novak.
Oh, that's been, and that's obviously a bestseller and become quite a sensation. It's really fun. It's fun to read. It's saying, this is the secret of books, kids. Whoever is reading the book to you has to say whatever the words say. So it says a lot of kind of nonsense words and kind of makes fun of the reader. It says, I'm a monkey who just learned how to read. And the kids, you know, crack up. But it's interesting because it's a picture book with no picture. So it's also...
B.J. Novak, the actor, comedian, TV writer, who is the author of this book, was very strict about there being no pictures. I remember there was apparently a question of whether they could even have like the penguin, icon of the penguin on the spine. He really wanted there to be not a single picture and to show that you could still tell an engaging story.
Yeah, and our reviewer, Mark Levine, says in a way it's the most subversive message of all now. It's that, you know, the words are really what's important in a picture book.
Let's quickly talk about a couple of the novels. One of them has been gathering awards already and nominations, Rain, Rain.
Yeah, this is by Anne M. Martin, who is kind of a household name for the series called The Babysitter's Club, and then another series called Family Tree.
That's one that she has currently. I think that she's in the third of the four installments of that series.
But this one is a standalone book about a girl who has autism, and it's told in the voice of the girl. So she really gets into the way the autistic brain thinks and processes. And the main problem for kids with autism is loneliness, and she really gets to that. It's very hard for them to connect to their peers. This girl finds a dog. Her dad finds a stray dog that becomes her closest companion, and there's a flood, and the dog is lost, and so there's actually a lot of drama and conflict and a really happy ending, even for all the sadness. And this is one of those that I think parents will sneak a read all the way through too, because it's just a very touching story that gets you inside of what it's like to have autism.
And another middle grade book, very different topic, reviewed in this issue, Arcady's Goal, written and illustrated by Eugene Yelchin. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's another great one. It's the story of a boy whose parents are taken away by Stalin for being enemies of the state, and he's sent to a home for these children. It's a harsh existence, as you can imagine, but he's great at soccer, so he that's what saves him and gets him through, and his dream is to become part of the Red Army soccer team. A man who kind of watches the children playing soccer picks him out, and eventually what happens is this man ends up adopting him, and the book ends with they're on their way to the Red Army tryout, and we don't know if he's going to make it, but I think the point that our reviewer, Rich Cohen, points out is he's already reached his goal. He's found a father, and the father who had lost his wife also has found a child. So it's just really well done, and also he's an illustrator too, so the illustrations are telling the story as you're reading, and it's
he's
really,
a terrific illustrator. Actually, yeah. Does a lot of picture books. Now, you also wrote one of the most positive rave reviews in the issue,
maybe that I've ever written.
This is a story we think we all know well, but tell us about Neil Gaiman's version of Hansel and Gretel.
Yeah, this is just, it really knocked me out. I have to say, I wasn't expecting it to be so powerful. He's taken the traditional Hansel and Gretel Grimm's tale and just sort of notched it up in certain ways. He's made it take place during a time of war, for example. So you start to see, you know, why is there a famine happening? And the soldiers come through town, and that's why this little family is in so much distress. He's also made the mother, not a stepmother, but the actual mother, the person who wants to send the children off because there's no food for them. So there's little touches like that just make it scary, but also kind of deep. And you can't separate, of course, the illustrations in a book like this by the illustrator and artist Lorenzo Mattotti, who does a lot of work for The New Yorker. Very stark black and white ink drawings with all kinds of shadings that really give you the sense that this is a story about darkness and light, you know, the darkness and light of the human condition. And
this is not the Golden Book version.
No, it's really not.
The tale.
But you know, one thing that Neil Gaiman says a lot is that you have to have some brightness when you're doing horror and you're doing scary stories. You have to also show a way out into the light. And I think that's what he does. And I think the illustrations do it, too.
All right. Well, there is a lot more in the issue. Thanks, Maria, so much for joining us and telling us
Thank you.
A bit about the highlights. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
So what's new on the list this week?
Well, listeners may remember last week there was finally a new George R.R. Martin book, but it was disappointingly not part of his Game of Thrones. not part of the Game of Thrones series, but a kid's book. This week, I am compelled to tell them that there is another new George R.R. Martin book. And again, it's not a new Game of Thrones novel. It is part of the Game of Thrones series. It's a book on our advice, how-to, and miscellaneous list, new at number 2, called The World of Ice and Fire. It is one of these kind of peripheral books that purports to tell the history of Westeros and just more about the world of Game of Thrones.
Okay.
So he's still cashing in, but he has not yet delivered the final book in that series yet, or the next book in that series
yet. I thought it was going to be a how-to on fire and ice, but I guess not. Okay.
Then over on the regular fiction and nonfiction hardcover lists, there's quite a lot, actually. On the fiction side of things, William Gibson, the science fiction writer, has a new book at number 9 called The Peripheral. At number 7, Danielle Steele's got a historical family epic set around the time of World War II called Pegasus. At number 6, Alexander McCall Smith continues his number 1 ladies detective agency series. The 15th book in that series is called The Handsome Man's Deluxe Cafe. Then at number 4, Clive Cussler and his son Dirk Cussler have the latest book in their Dirk Pitt series. It's called Havana Storm, not to be confused with the ESPN anchor Hannah Storm. Then at number 3, Anne Rice continues her Interview with the Vampire series. The first new book in this series in 11 or 12 years, I think. It's called Prince Lestat, and it is about the vampire Lestat.
A long series of series. Is the next one a series too?
As a matter of fact, it is. It's another book that's kind of peripheral to a series. This is part of Patrick Rothfuss's Kingkiller Chronicles fantasy series. It's new at number 2. It's called The Slow Regard of Silent Things. It's a novella that takes you into the world of one of the minor characters in that series, the character Ori. The series is really a trilogy, but he has kind of branched off to do various side projects within that trilogy. This is one of them.
What's going on with nonfiction?
Quite a lot on the nonfiction list.
Lots of celebrity, right?
Yeah. Starting down at number 16, Rick Bragg, the former New York Times reporter, has a biography of Jerry Lee Lewis, the rock and roll pioneer who's still alive and who cooperated with this biography. That's new at number 16. It's just called Jerry Lee Lewis. Then at number 15, Barbara Leeming has a book, Jacqueline Bouvier Kennedy Onassis, and it's really about Jackie's life after JFK's assassination.
Finally, someone wrote a book about her.
Then at number 14, a book called Miracles by Eric Metaxas, arguing that miracles are all around us. At number 15, the Harvard historian and New Yorker staff writer Jill Lepore, who's very prolific as an author but has never had a bestseller before, has her first bestseller. It's called The Secret History of Wonder Woman. And it's partly a cultural study of Wonder Woman, the comic book, and partly a biography of Wonder Woman's creator, William Marston, who had a really interesting life. He was very influenced by early feminism. He was married but also lived with another woman. They both bore him children. They lived very happily as a family throughout. And she really kind of traces the threads of feminism right from the early 20th century through Wonder Woman and then into the second wave of feminism.
Why did this one land on the bestseller list and not the one about the sister of Benjamin Franklin?
Then at number 9, our old friend Glenn Beck is back with his frequent collaborator Kevin Balfe. His latest book is called Dreamers and Deceivers. At number 5, Derek Jeter, who earlier this year had a children's book after his retirement, now is on the adult list with a book written with Anthony Baza called Jeter Unfiltered, talking about his career and life. And finally, new at number 1, the Saturday Night Live writer and actress and the star of Parks and Recreation, Amy Poehler, has a sort of a memoir, sort of just a jokish miscellany called Yes, Please, and that makes its entrance on the list at number one.
I feel like Dwight Garner's review this week was kind of a no thank you to,
that,
to Amy
Poehler.
That
was his response. He said there's a few good things that you can rake into a small pile, but otherwise it's kind of plowing through it.
Well, can't stop it sales-wise. All right, thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.